run on Russia start joint naval drills north of the Indian Ocean aimed at establishing security for international trade. Israeli forces arrested a dozen Palestinians after raiding several neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank. Thousands of Algerians rallied to mark the second anniversary of a mass movement that ousted veteran president Abdelaziz Bouteflika. Hi, everybody. From Tehran, I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Top story, Iran and Russia have kicked off a large-scale naval drill in the Sea of Oman, as well as north of the Indian Ocean. The joint maneuvers are aimed at promoting collective security for international maritime trade, among other things. Yusuf Jalali has a report.
Russia's Turkey frigate arrived in the Sea of Oman on Tuesday to take part in a joint naval maneuver with Iran. Codenamed Joint Drills for Marine Security in north of the Indian Ocean, the two-day maneuvers are carried out in a 17,000 square kilometer area in the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Aside from Stoike, the Russian Navy has deployed its Kola bunkering vessel as well.
On behalf of the Russian Federation and Navy, I congratulate you on the drill, and I hope that the exercises will go on successfully based on the planned scenarios.
The maneuvers feature anti-terrorism operations, search and rescue operations, as well as drills to repel attacks by pirates. The ultimate goal is to ensure collective security for international maritime trade in the Strait of Hormuz, which is a highly sensitive waterway as one-fifth of the world's oil shipments pass through it.
This war game has a message, the message of peace and friendship, and it calls on all countries, on countries of the Indian Ocean and the regional countries, to contribute to collective, to the establishment of collective security in the region against enemies, against the enmity of the global arrogance. And of course, regional countries have shown goodwill in this regard. The message of all of Iran maneuvers for the regional countries and our neighbors is peace, friendship, and calling on them to take part in establishing naval security and being responsible for establishing security in the region, which is located between three strategic straits: the Strait of Hormuz to the north of the Indian Ocean, Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and another strait. These three straits are places where most of the world's energy go through. So definitely collective cooperation among regional countries will play a key part in establishing security here. This has been our message all the time, that regional security should be ensured by regional countries. And we should not ask countries from beyond the region to establish security for us.
The Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean are connected to the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. has over the past years been trying to expand its military presence in this sensitive region by clinching trade deals with Persian Gulf Arab states and conducting joint maneuvers with them. Iran has repeatedly criticized the U.S.'s expansionist agenda in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, saying this has only stoked insecurity and instability in the region. Long acting as Iran's close political and economic ally, Russia now proved to be an effective security partner for Iran. Officials say one of the goals of this drill is to cement this partnership as a counterforce to, quote, the U.S.'s destabilizing presence in the Persian Gulf. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
Welcome to the News Review. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has blasted Israel for refusing to allow COVID-19 vaccine delivery to the besieged Gaza Strip. Hamas' spokesman Hazem Qassam described Israel's move as a real crime and a violation of all international laws and humanitarian norms. The Palestinian Authority urged the World Health Organization to condemn Israel for obstructing coronavirus vaccine doses destined for Gaza. A PA spokesman says that the WHO and other international organizations have been asked to hold Tel Aviv fully responsible for the dangers arising from its prevention of vaccines into the Strip. On Monday, the Palestinian Health Ministry based in the West Bank announced that Israel had blocked the transfer of 2,000 doses of Russian Sputnik V to Gaza. The coastal enclave has been under Israeli blockade since 2007. Now let's get some insight regarding this. First, we'll go to Gaza City. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon is there, and then we'll be joined by also Laith Marav, activist and political commentator out of Beirut. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Ashraf, tell us about what the COVID-19 situation there is like in the Gaza Strip.
Well, Bahrouz, the current number of infections, mostly since late August 2020, is nearly 54,000 infections and more than 500 deaths in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The decision by the Israeli regime to block the entry of the vaccines yesterday into the Gaza Strip has drawn angry reactions by Palestinian factions, mainly Hamas, who described it as an act of aggression against the Palestinian people, and also a racist move by the Israeli regime, and called on the World Health Organization to pressure Tel Aviv into allowing the vaccines into the Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm. Other Palestinian groups have called the act by the Israeli regime as a war crime against the Palestinian people. Also, human rights organizations have slammed this move by Tel Aviv to prevent the entry of vaccine into the Gaza Strip. Gaza has been under a tight blockade since 2007. Has faced three Israeli wars. The health system in Gaza has been battered by the wars and the blockade. And Israel continues to violate international laws and norms by preventing the entry of the vaccine. Many believe that the normalization of ties between some Arab countries, mainly in the Persian Gulf region, has encouraged Tel Aviv to further violate the rights of the Palestinian people and also to act more aggressive against the Palestinians.
Okay. Now let me turn to Beirut. Laith, good to have you with us on the show. As you heard our correspondent speak about the situation in Gaza, they were already facing a host of issues of different kinds, being under siege for long years. And on top of that comes COVID-19 and all the problems, that's actually kind of wreaked havoc across the planet. Even the largest countries in the U.S. is the worst hit, as you know. So as an occupying force, based on international law, Tel Aviv has to, it's obliged to actually take care and do something about it. It's responsible for the well-being and the health issues and medical care of the Palestinians. What can be done about this?
You are right. As an occupying power, apartheid Israel is responsible for the well-being of the occupied peoples, the Palestinians. And we've heard a couple of weeks ago when apartheid Israel was bragging about starting its own vaccination of its colonial population. And at the time, the Palestinian Authority pointed out that none of those vaccines were coming to the Palestinian territories occupied in 1967. And the answer from the apartheid Israel was that the Palestinians are responsible for their own vaccination. And now that the Palestinians have stepped up and found some partners like Russia to donate some of the vaccines and attempted to deliver them to Gaza, we hear that apartheid Israel is not going to allow it. So it's really unbelievable how the apartheid Israel finds excuses after excuses to continue to commit war crimes and crimes against humanity, and it has to be held responsible. Unfortunately, the West is colluding with apartheid Israel for the last 70 somewhat years in its war crimes and will not hold it responsible. So it's up to the resistance to hold apartheid Israel responsible for these war crimes.
Like, do you think, because the condemnations have been coming from different international organizations, but is there anything that can be really done for the Palestinians so that they could get some treatment they need?
Well, just charging, as we've seen the International Criminal Court charging officials in apartheid Israel with war crimes, maybe this should be added to the list right now. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the only thing that forces apartheid Israel to do anything to deliver on its obligations within international law is force, because, and obviously the West is not willing to force apartheid Israel.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. Ashraf Shannon, a correspondent, joined us from Gaza City, and Light Maruf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. And that's it for this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Let's move ahead with this broadcast. Israeli forces have raided several neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank, arresting a dozen Palestinians. According to Palestinian media, the raids took place early on Tuesday morning. Israeli soldiers attacked the homes in the cities of Nablus, Ramallah, and Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. Two members of the Hamas resistance movement were also among the detainees. Troops frequently attack Palestinian homes in the occupied territories and arrest people. Most of them are jailed under the regime's so-called administrative detention, and that allows them imprison the Palestinians for an indefinite period of time without any charge or trial. Now, elsewhere in the world, thousands of Algerians have hit the streets to mark the second anniversary of a mass movement that forced longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to step down. Demonstrators gathered in Kharrata, a city east of the capital Algiers, which was the birthplace of the movement. They held Algerian flags and chanted slogans against the military and the current government, defying COVID restrictions and a ban on protests. Algeria witnessed massive street rallies in 2019 after Bouteflika announced his bid for a fifth term in office. The demonstrations triggered an unprecedented months-long movement called Hirak, demanding a sweeping overhaul of the ruling system in place since the country's independence from France in 1962. Now, those rallies came to a halt in March 2020 because of the pandemic. The North African country has seen a number of demonstrations recently. U.S. House of Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that lawmakers will establish an outside and independent commission to review the last month's insurrection on the Capitol. She said in a letter to lawmakers that the commission would be modeled on a similar one convened after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Pelosi added that the commission will review the facts and causes related to the deadly Capitol raid by supporters of then-President Donald Trump. But that after the Senate acquitted Trump on impeachment charge of inciting the attack on the Congress building on January the 6th. The United Kingdom has reached its ambitious mid-February target of 15 million people, inoculating everyone in the country's top four priority groups against COVID-19. But with this successful vaccination gamble come growing calls for the lifting of lockdown restrictions and a wary people that's hoping the government knows what exactly it's doing. Saeed Purazar reports.
This country has achieved an extraordinary feat, administering a total of 15 million jabs into the arms of some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
One of few successes in the UK government's handling of a pandemic that's left the country of about 67 million with a higher death toll and worse economic damage than many others. But with the situation improving, should the government open the country up for business? Members of the Prime Minister's own party are calling on him to commit to a timetable for scrapping the lockdown in the coming months. But the Prime Minister says he will only follow the evidence.
We've got to be very prudent, and what we want to see is progress that is cautious but irreversible.
Infections are falling but remain high, and former Prime Minister Tony Blair thinks the way to stop them soaring when the restrictions are eased is to issue vaccine passports, certificates that prove you have received the jab.
I think it's a step too far to have your movement controlled locally by some kind of passport or a piece of paper. I think that's way too far.
Some people cannot be vaccinated because of health reasons. It's just not safe for them. So to discriminate against those people and say, well, you're just not able to go to a coffee shop, go to a different country, that doesn't seem particularly just and fair.
On Monday, Health Secretary Matt Hancock insisted vaccine passports were not for domestic use. That seemed to resonate well with the people we spoke to.
I think it's a really good idea, you know. I think that so as we can travel is the main thing, really, what I'm sort of interested in, getting abroad for a bit of sun.
I think it's a good idea. I think if it means we can get back to doing summer holidays and travelling abroad, seeing family abroad, then I don't see why not.
Monday saw the launching of the UK's hotel quarantine regime, a new 10-day isolation for British residents returning from 33 COVID variant hotspots. Critics say the move is too little too late.
The UK is under an indefinite lockdown at the moment to curb the spread of the virus. Next week, the Prime Minister will unveil his so-called roadmap for the months ahead. But with his track record riddled with failures in handling the pandemic since it began, will Boris Johnson get it right this time? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Now let's take a look at the COVID situation around the world. Confirmed cases in the U.S. are approaching 27.7 million, fatalities surpassing 486,000, that according to Johns Hopkins University. The United States has the largest infection and death tallies in the world. Authorities have urged people to avoid travel, but around 4 million traveled by air from Thursday to Sunday. Now, that marked the past weekend having the highest number of passengers in the U.S. so far this year. Also in the Americas, Brazil on Monday reported 32,000 new cases and 500 new fatalities in the past day. The country has 240,000 deaths out of almost 9.9 million cases. The death toll in Mexico has jumped to 174,000 from nearly 2 million infection cases. Now here in Iran, officials reporting 89 new fatalities from the coronavirus, taking the overall tally to some 59,000. Health Ministry spokeswoman says that 8,000 new infections were also reported in one day. And that brings to more than 1.5 million the total number of cases. So far, 1.3 million people have managed to recover from the deadly disease. Iran saw a relative decline in number of both deaths and infections since it implemented restrictions in mid-November. The figures kind of climbed up since the new cases of the UK variant were detected in the country. An unprecedented winter storm has hit large parts of the United States, battering at least two dozen states. Texas, Kentucky, Mississippi, Oregon, and Oklahoma are among affected states. Four people have already been killed in storm-related incidents. The National Weather Service says 150 million people are under winter weather advisories. The storm has disrupted transportation, too. It's also caused power outages as demand for electricity has surged. In Texas alone, more than 4 million people have been left without electricity. President Biden has approved a state of emergency there. The storm is forecast to continue on Tuesday. Indians have held rallies in several cities to demand the release of an environmentalist accused of drumming up support for farmers' protests against new controversial laws. Protesters took to the streets of Bengaluru, New Delhi, and Mumbai in solidarity with 22-year-old Disha Ravi. Police claim that Ravi created and shared a toolkit online to foment violence during a tractor rally by farmers last month. Her supporters have denied the allegations, saying that the toolkit was about farmers' protests and had nothing to do with the violence. A number of opposition parties have also demanded her immediate release. The arrests came as the government of Prime Minister Modi is facing criticism for cracking down on dissent. Tens of thousands of farmers are still camping on the outskirts of the capital, demanding the rollback of new farm laws. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. future. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Seven Republican senators who broke ranks by voting to convict former President Donald Trump at his impeachment trial faced immediate hostility and criticism from fellow conservatives, revealing the potentially high cost of opposing Trumpism within the Republican Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Victoria Bekempis. The piece is titled Seven Republican Rebels Who Voted to Convict Feel Trumpists' Fury. Stay with us for more. The seven Republican senators who broke ranks by voting to convict former President Donald Trump at his impeachment trial faced immediate hostility and criticism from fellow conservatives, revealing the potentially high cost of opposing Trumpism within the Republican Party. These senators, North Carolina's Richard Burr, Louisiana's Bill Cassidy, Maine's Susan Collins, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, Utah's Mitt Romney, Nebraska's Ben Sasse, and Pennsylvania's Pat Toomey, brought the total number of guilty votes to 57. That was not nearly enough to secure a conviction, but easily enough to ensure instant attack from fellow Republicans and others on the right of the Republican Party. The reaction was a powerful illustration of the strength of Donald Trump's grip on the Republican Party, even though he's out of office. Let's impeach Renos from the Republican Party. Donald Trump's son and conservative favorite, Donald Trump Jr., said on Twitter, using the insulting acronym for Republicans in name only, RENO. The instant backlash came from powerful right-wing media figures as well. Conservative Fox News host Laura Ingraham commented, "Prediction: none of the Republicans who voted in the affirmative today will speak at the 2024 GOP convention." For Senator Cassidy, there was almost instant retribution from his own state. Jeff Landry, the Republican Attorney General of Louisiana, tweeted, "Senator Bill Cassidy's vote is extremely disappointing. The local party agreed and its executive committee unanimously voted to censure Cassidy for his vote. We condemn in the strongest possible terms the vote today by Senator Bill Cassidy to convict former President Donald Trump. Fortunately, clearer heads prevailed, and President Trump has been acquitted of the impeachment charge filed against him," the Republican Party of Louisiana similarly said in a statement. Bill Cassidy was not alone, as Richard Burr's state party in North Carolina also went immediately on the attack. Michael Whatley, North Carolina's Republican Party chair, condemned his colleague in a statement, saying, "North Carolina Republicans sent Senator Burr to the United States Senate to uphold the Constitution, and his vote today to convict in a trial that he declared unconstitutional is shocking and disappointing." Even Republicans who voted to acquit Donald Trump were not necessarily spared from conservative backlash, including the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. The lawmaker said that he voted to acquit over a jurisdictional issue, and because Donald Trump was no longer in office, Mitch McConnell didn't think impeachment was in its purview. However, McConnell also firmly criticized Donald Trump following the acquittal, saying, "There is no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of that day, and that he's still liable for everything he did whilst he was in office. He didn't get away with anything yet." Trump's circle was displeased at the lack of fealty, despite the vote to acquit. If only Mitch McConnell was so righteous as the Democrats trampled Trump and the Republicans whilst pushing Russia collusion theory for 3 years, or whilst Democrats incited 10 months of violence, arson and rioting. Yet then he just sat back and did nothing, said Trump Jr. These attacks come as party-line Republicans have ratcheted up their efforts to unseat dissenting conservatives in upcoming primaries. The 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Trump are already seeing primary opponents trying to unseat them and replace them with Trump loyalists. Matt Gaetz, a Florida Republican congressman and dogged Trump loyalist, even flew to Cheyenne in Wyoming in late January to hold a rally against senior Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who backed impeachment. "Defeat Liz Cheney in this upcoming election," Matt Gaetz commented. "And Wyoming will bring Washington to its knees. How can you call yourself a representative when you don't represent the will of the people?" Matt Gaetz also described Liz Cheney, the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney, as a beltway bureaucrat turned fake cowgirl that supported an impeachment that is deeply unpopular in the state of Wyoming.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
One of the things that we owe Imam al-Hadi great appreciation on is the blessing of the ziyarah known as Ziyarah Jami'ah al-Kabira. This ziyarah is an amazing piece of work. It is a compilation of the qualities, the traits of the Ahlul Bayt, their relationship with Allah, and their relationship with us. Imam al-Hadi, at his time, he releases this ziyarah that, I think I've mentioned this before, Allama Tabatabai used to recite it every time he went for ziyarah for any of the Ahl Bayt. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, he was in Najaf for about 14 years. His daily routine was around, if I remember the timing correctly, he had a very set schedule. Daily routine in at night time, I think it was around 9 p.m. every single day. Haram of Amir al-Mu'minin. Every single day. Not only that, that's the imams. When he was in Qum, he would visit the shrine of the Lady Ma'suma salamullahi alayha every single day. They went to him after he became a marja. Before that he was a scholar, he would go to the haram of the Lady Fatima Ma'suma salamullahi alayha every day. He became a marja, he started continuing that. They came to him. Look at this. Al-Ayyadu Billah. They came to him, some of the people around him, maybe some of his students, some of the people in his office, they came to him and said, look, now you're a marja, it's not appropriate for a marja to go every single day. Once a week is enough. Imam Khomeini said, if you knew who she is, you would have never uttered those words. You would have never said anything like Utla Bahjat every single day in Qom. We didn't get to see Imam Khomeini going, but we did see any time that we were there, we tried to. We heard, everybody knew that's the routine. Utla Bahjat goes every single day, 30 minutes. Allama Tabatabai, every time he would go to the Haram of the Ahlul Bayt, any one of them, Ziyara Jama'a Kabira, read it. We've got to read this Ziyara. We've got to learn from it. And pay attention to the meanings, accurately understand this. Unfortunately, one of the ulama, it's public, I will mention his name, he had his view, he's a respectable person, I respect him as one of our ulama, Sayyid Fadlullah, may Allah bless his soul. He was one of the ulama, one of the scholars. He had certain views, we may differ with him, that doesn't mean we need to disrespect him for his view. He believes Ziyara Jama'a Kabira is a fabrication. Okay, it's not actually from the imams. There are others that have that view as well. And they think that one of the reasons they present is that the words of this, what this attributes to the Ahlul Bayt is shirk. And here's where and our teachers, but we ourselves have worked on that ziyara and we paid close attention, we tried to study that ziyara very well. And the more you attend to it, the more you split hair, the more you study the text, and then you compare it with the Qur'an, the more you realize not only what is attributed there to the Ahlul Bayt is shirk, only the Ahlul Bayt could word a ziyara that precisely, which holds the boundary between tawheed and shirk. It is an amazing piece of work. And we've got to study it. You have some speakers that come and when they want to present the status of the Ahlul Bayt, they make up stuff about the Ahlul Bayt. They say things that are not found in the words of the Ahlul Bayt. Inshallah, there aren't too many, but we do come to know that there are some that do that. You don't need to do that. You don't need to do that. Understand what they have said, present it. That itself is beyond, it blows our mind away. If I were to just give a rough gist of the ziyara on that part, because there's different segments and each of them are trying to present a different aspect of our relationship with the Ahlul Bayt. As I said, it explains the relationship of the Ahlul Bayt with Allah and our relationship with the Ahlul Bayt. The gist of it is this, and some of the lines explicitly say this, but I'll just mention the gist. The gist of it is this. The Ahlul Bayt are the connection of all creation to Allah. Whatever blessing anyone from the beginning of creation to the end has received, is receiving from this material realm to the angels, to paradise, and the whole thing, all of it is blessings that Allah gives through the Ahlul Bayt. Through the Ahlul Bayt. Nothing that anyone has, mu'min or kafir, Muslim or mushrik, whoever, human being, animals, molecule, anything you can imagine. Whatever they have is Allah giving them through the Ahlul Bayt. Allah intended it to come through the Ahlul Bayt. Without any exaggeration, I mean everything, spiritual blessings, material blessings, knowledge. One of the lines says, Khuzanul ilm. Khuzanul ilm. They are protectors of knowledge. In Arabic, this lam there, al-ilm, khuzan means protectors. And then it says khuzan al-ilm. That lam there, ilm means knowledge. The lam there, they call it lamul jins. Means whatever can be referred to as knowledge, khuzanul ilm. There is no limitation on that. There is no qualifier on that. There is nothing mentioned before or after that tells you it's referring to a specific type of knowledge. Khuzanul ilm,
any type of knowledge that God has bestowed any creation, the protectors, the holders, the ones that possess it and give it, are the Ahlul Bayt. Ma'adinu Rahmah. Again, the lam there is jinns. Rahmah means blessings, mercy. Anything that can be referred to as a blessing. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Ar-Rahman. Anything that you see around you has an element of blessing and rahmah in it. They are ma'adinu rahmah, the source of rahmah. God created them. When you want gold, you go to a gold mine. That's the source. That's where you find gold. You go to the oil fields. That's where you pump oil out. That's called a ma'adin. Ma'adin al-Rahmah. The source of Rahmah.
Ya Ahlul Bayt. Salawatullah wa salamu alayhim ajma'in.
The question is, now that we have just briefly mentioned a couple of lines there, and those were the important lines, the gist of it, and I encourage all of us to read this ziyarah. There's a reason why they didn't limit the ziyarah to just a couple of words and saying everything comes through us. They didn't. It's a very long. It takes 30 minutes for you to read it quickly. 30 minutes to read it quickly. It's very wordy. The same idea is presented in a few different ways. There's a reason for that. It takes all of that for us to digest that material.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimul Halim Hakimun Mateen شكرٌ ودود قيومٌ رؤوف صبورٌ مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The failure to contain COVID in the U.S. confirmed that U.S. approach to health care and public health is broken, and former President Donald Trump made a bad situation worse, says Mike Ludwig, reporter, in an article published under the heading, New Lancet Report Shows 40% of U.S. COVID deaths could have been avoided. Here's the details. If the United States had death rates on par with other wealthy nations, there would have been 40% fewer deaths attributed to COVID-19 last year. In 2018 alone, an estimated 461,000 fewer people would have died if the U.S. was as healthy as other countries. The failure to contain COVID in the U.S. confirmed that U.S. approach to healthcare and public health is broken. And former President Donald Trump made a bad situation worse. That's the message from a multidisciplinary commission of experts assembled to study the Trump administration by The Lancet, a long-standing medical journal that has publicly tussled with Trump over the course of the pandemic. Since 2017, the international team of 33 leading experts in clinical medicine, public health, epidemiology, community medicine, economics, nutrition, law, and politics has analyzed how the Trump administration's policies impact health. The result is a scathing and detailed new report that is an indictment of both Trump and a healthcare system that values profit over human life. The life expectancy in the U.S. began falling behind peers such as the United Kingdom, Germany, and France when Ronald Reagan became president in 1980. According to Kevin Grumbach, a professor of family and community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and co-author of the report, that is the turning point where health started falling in the United States compared to other G7 nations, Grumbach said in an interview. We totally shifted to conservative and neoliberal policies, and that corresponds with a deteriorating health in the U.S. relative to other nations, he added. Reagan instated policies that reduced the government's role in healthcare and education and accelerated the concentration of wealth among the upper classes. Since then, life expectancy has dropped 3.4 years behind other wealthy countries and remains even lower among black people and Native Americans. The report found that before the pandemic, rates of midlife mortality among black people and Native Americans were 42 and 59% higher, respectively, than for white people. People of color are more likely to die from COVID than white people, and the mortality gap between black and white people has grown by 50% during the pandemic. The disastrous bungled response to the pandemic made clear how existing, long-standing racial inequities simply have not been addressed, said Mary T. Bassett, director of the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University and a member of the commission, in a statement recently. Reagan's neoliberal political philosophy stuck around under both Democratic and Republican administrators and created conditions for the rise of Trump. The report links health to trade liberalization that led to the outsourcing of manufacturing jobs, weakened unions, and left many parts of the U.S. to struggle economically. According to the report, Trump exploited anger among white voters over their deteriorating life prospects and stoked racism and nativism to win the 2016 election. That's the epidemic that we have been struggling through, not just through 4 years of Trump, but 40 years of failing to create the conditions that make for a wealthy and healthy society, Grumbach said. As soon as he took office, Trump and Republicans in Congress moved to destroy the Affordable Care Act, which expanded health insurance for the millions of American people. the GOP's signature of achievement, a massive tax cut for wealthy nation, open holes in the federal budget that conservatives used to justify spending cuts on health and food assistance. While attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act failed spectacularly in Congress, the Trump administration used its executive powers to undermine the law. During the first 3 years of Trump tenure, the number of people with health coverage dropped by 2.3 million, largely due to Trump's attacks on Medicaid, the program that provides health coverage to low-income people. About 760,000 kids and teens lost health coverage. Before the pandemic hit, the Trump administration proposed $920 billion in Medicaid cuts and was poised to require burdensome eligibility checks that would have pushed more people out of the program, according to the report. The Trump administration consistently favored corporate interest over public health. When it came to climate and environment, and openly worked on behalf of the fossil fuel industry. The administration rolled back dozens of environmental regulations, allowing companies to spew more dangerous pollution into the air. Between 2016 and 2019, the number of deaths related to environmental and occupation hazards spiked to 22,000 after years of steady decline, according to the report. The administration also repeatedly attempted to suppress data showing the effects that pollution has on human health. The list goes on, but the Trump administration's response to the pandemic stands out. Grombach said Trump had already cut staff at public health agencies by the time the pandemic hit, severely weakening the nation's response. Meanwhile, Trump consistently spread disinformation about COVID, providing a preview of his efforts to overturn the election he lost. Attempting to deflect blame for a botched COVID response, Trump attacked China and World Health Organization, even citing The Lancet in a blistering letter to the WHO. The Lancet editor stepped in and confirmed that Trump was lying. By October 2020, the U.S. had the highest death rates among 18 other high-income countries, both from COVID and other health problems. However, Grombach said the problems exposed by COVID are bigger than Trump. Behind Trump's bluster and weakness in the face of the virus is a neoliberal ideology that shapes American healthcare system and sets the U.S. apart from other nations. It's an ideology that values corporate profits over the lives of the vulnerable and sees healthcare as a commodity to be bought and sold rather than a human right. In such an environment, public health measures such as masking in public and providing healthcare to immigrants are subject to polarizing debates, even though they benefit everyone. The Lancet's commission concludes that simply returning to pre-Trump era policies will not be enough to protect health of American people. Grombach said the entire system needs an overhaul. For starters, the U.S. should transition to a single-payer healthcare system like those set up in nations that have better life expectancy. Polling shows that 56% of likely voters in the U.S. support Medicare for All, the single-payer proposal championed by Senator Bernie Sanders and other progressives. Support for a public option that would compete with private insurance is even higher, although many people support both. The Commission recommendations go far beyond the healthcare system. A massive mobilization of resources, a Green New Deal, is needed to confront climate change, which poses myriad threats to public health. The U.S. spends 3.4% of its GDP on the military, but G7 countries with lower mortality rates only spend an average of 1.4% of GDP on defense. If the U.S. reduces foreign intervention and military spending to 1.4% of GDP, a massive amount of resources could be redirected to urgent social needs. Additionally, the war on drugs must come to an end, and new investments should be made in communities of color harmed by the criminal legal system and mass incarceration, according to the Commission. While the wealthy have thrived, most Americans have lost ground, both economically and medically, said Steffi Woodhandler, who co-chairs the Lancet Commission and lectures at Hunter College in Harvard. The Biden administration must reboot democracy and implement the progressive social health policies needed to put the country on the road to better life.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
I would like to quote a comment by Western official. I do not usually quote these Western politicians and prominent Western figures, but this particular comment is interesting. He says that if Muslim nations find out about the possibility, which is both practical and has practically happened in Islamic Iran, then it will not be possible to prevent revolutions from happening. Today, this has already happened. Of course, it is not a recent development. This has been going on for 30 years. A concept occurs to nations, and it gradually spreads and takes root among them. Later on, this concept manifests itself in the form of events happening in North Africa and other parts of the world. Of course, Westerners themselves made some political mistakes. These political mistakes helped the Islamic Republic. Notice that Westerners made a mistake in the case of nuclear issue. In order to confront Iran's nuclear activities, they magnified the nuclear issue. They created uproar. They pressured the Islamic Republic to back down in the case of the nuclear issue.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
It is 7 years now that they have been trying. Well, two issues became clear to people of the world during the past 7 years. The first issue is that Iran has managed to achieve unexpected advances in nuclear technology. The second issue is that Iran has stood firm in spite of all this pressure, and it will not retreat. This was in the interest of the Iranian nation. Now, the entire world knows that America, Europe, and their subordinates and followers did not manage to overwhelm the Islamic Republic, in spite of all the pressure they exerted on it. The entire world knows that they did not manage to force the Islamic Republic to retreat. This characteristic was propagated by the enemies of the Iranian nation. That is to say, they helped introduce the Iranian nation to the world.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.